Your Honor, this is a robbery case, and it is an identity case in which the victim of the robbery identifies the defendant, Gary Williams, as being the robber. In the brief that I filed, I talked a lot about the facts of the case because I think that the facts play into what I think is the important issue in the case, which is prejudice of a piece of evidence that was placed in the record by the Commonwealth Attorney. It's interesting, my son Chris Lesky tried this case in when he was doing sort of work and took over the appeal with the court's appointment. I don't know if I want to go through the facts, but I will go through the facts about
if I could, let me kind of get you something that I have some concern
about.
It
was a close case.
Yes, sir.
It was a close case.
In this case, would you agree that the defense decided to put on a defensive alibi?
The defendant testified regarding alibi, and that there's no question about that. But the issue is the witness, his wife, unusual name, Carsey Williams. There's a witness that's involved, and as I said, the case is not a slam dunk, it's a close case. And under some circumstances, the Commonwealth might have lost the case, as well as won it. It could have gone either way. But Carsey is called as a witness as the defendant's alibi to bolster his testimony, his anticipated testimony, that he was somewhere else at the time and wasn't there, and that here my wife is going to testify on my behalf to bolster bolster my testimony that it wasn't me.
And if that is indeed the case, sir, isn't the government entitled to try to discredit that alibi?
Yes. But the point is that Carsey never did that. Carsey never testified that my client was not there. She said, I thought he was. It probably was that way, but I really don't know. And I want to point out where she said, that it was probably so. In the record that Carsey was unable to recall, that's a point page 217 of the appendix, he's unable to recall the dates. And the best you could say at page 1228 was it could have been. And then if you go to the disc that was played by the Commonwealth's attorney twice during his cross-examination and during his argument to the jury, it's the same sort of thing. There's no contradiction. There's no bolstering of the alibi. The plain reading of her testimony at trial and during the telephone calls was essentially the same, with the defendant saying, don't you remember? Don't you really remember? Wasn't it really like this? And she never got beyond it could have been or was probable. With that said, if you listen to the disc, it's full of foul, crude language. There are racial slurs in it, and the effect of that prejudice the defendant. Now, I know our cases always say, well, that's the whole idea of this sort of testimony or that was presented as a prejudiced defendant. But it wasn't brought to a prejudiced defendant that Carsey was making up a story or had been told to do that by the defendant. Rather, the prejudice involves what shouldn't be placed in the record, which is these are crude people. These are lowlifes. and that because of that, it's likely that he would be a robber.
Did your son, as counsel in the case, take the alternative step? Just to give you an example, if you object to the testimony, you object to the admissibility of the evidence, and a secondary position is, okay, there are a lot of vulgarities and the like in here that are not part of the theory of the Commonwealth's case as far as the attack of the alibi, since you're not going to preclude the admission or admissibility of the evidence, I'm going to offer a cautionary instruction instructing the jury that you shall not consider the vulgarities, but rather to consider it only in the context of the alibi.
This is very interesting, Your Honor. There are some recent opinions from this court about that. In the first place, the cautionary instruction was offered by the court, and I think this was in the Arthur Clinton opinion. That was in April 18th of this year. In this case, the court never offered a cautionary instruction. The other business about a mistrial.
But did counsel ask for an instruction?
No, he did not. But my point is, if the judge allows it to come in, it's certainly not going to grant a mistrial over it, because the judge, by allowing it, made a ruling that the probative value is greater than any prejudice to the defendant. For a defendant to ask the trial judge, oh, judge, tell the jury not to pay any attention to the foul, dirty language of these people and what lowlifes they are, or racial slurs, and just don't consider that, I think is not a position that any defendant should be in, to ask for that. And this,
I'm not second-guessing that decision, but isn't that basically a strategic call? If defense counsel believes that the prejudicial effect of this is so severe that maybe the best option at this point, because the trial judge has decided to allow the admissibility of the tape, it's a secondary position. Okay, I need to make a decision as defense counsel whether or not I'm going to ask for a cautionary instruction, thereby potentially drawing more attention to it, or just letting it lie.
I agree that the defendant objected to it. And the safer, best thing for the trial judge to do, actually, in the defendant's position, a fairer thing to do, because it has so little probative value, is, or material value, too, is to say, no, we're not going to allow it. Once it's allowed, once it comes in, the defendant's in a position of trying to lessen the damage.
Mr. Zaleski, you didn't ask for any rebuttal time, but you have a little bit over 6 minutes left. I just wanted to let you know, in case you would like to reserve.
I would like to reserve probably a couple of minutes. I don't think it's an argument. I'm just about finished. This court, I'll call it in a violent sexual predator case, Chafin, Commonwealth versus Chafin, defined what a materiality would be, and that would be to prove the matter properly at issue. There was, and actually, the point is, there was no issue in this case about the Carsey's bolstering of the alibi, because she never did. The safer thing for the Commonwealth would have been is not to get involved in the whole thing. And once they do that, then I think it'd be improper for the Commonwealth to expect that the defendant would have had to bring attention to it and make it worse in order to preserve the error. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have about five and a half minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court.
Good afternoon.
Sorry for being a little late. I had a very unexpected development, serious problems getting through the Hampton Tunnel. I don't really have anything to say on the first issue, since the counsel hadn't addressed it, other than to about this inherently incredible. I'll just make two quick points and then move on to his argument. One, I think you can count literally on about one hand the number of appellate court decisions that have reversed a conviction based on the inherent credibility of a witness or the witnesses. This is certainly not one of those cases. And in fact, both in the opening statement at the supplemental appendix, page 2, and the closing argument, page 288 of the appendix, defense counsel conceded that the victim, Crumpler, had been robbed, that she wasn't making this story up out of whole cloth. It would be an exceedingly unusual case where the general assertion of a crime is conceded, but somehow the rest of it's inherently incredible. I just simply leave it at that on that. On the issue about the tapes, I don't really have a whole lot to add to what I've said on brief. I would make a few points. One is, I understand counsel's argument. Among other things, he says that the wife, I'll just say the wife and the girlfriend, just it's easier for me to keep it straight in my head. The wife, the one that he'd been married to for all of about 8 or 9 days, that she was equivocal at trial as to a possible testimony supporting the alibi. Well, that's certainly true in some of her testimony, but it's certainly not true at another point. According to the victim, she was robbed after she left work on this graveyard shift, and it would have been around 6:45 in the morning, and her mother's testimony was consistent with that time. The first responding officer, I think his last name was Stalcup, he indicated he got there around 7 a.m. So there's no question that the robbery occurred sometime in the neighborhood of 6:45 a.m. on December 8th of, I think it was 2011. Now, the wife was questioned because the girlfriend will say, the one that lived in the house with the defendant at least some of the time before and after his marriage, said that she'd lost her job on December 7th. It was obviously a very traumatic thing. She remembered that specific date. So the wife is questioned about the fact that on that same night that the girlfriend was fired, which again is December 7th, she remembered that night she, the wife, and the defendant were sleeping in a car outside a motel. So it's the night of December 7th leading into December 8th, and it's the morning of December 8th that the robbery occurs. So at bottom of page 227 of the appendix, she's asked, the night of the 7th into the 8th, was Gary with you? And then the entire morning, the 8th, answer, not the entire morning. I mean, he does have to pick up his kid, you know. I mean, get him dressed, put him on the bus and everything like that. Question, from 6 a.m. to 7 a.m., was he with you? Yes. When did he leave that morning to take the kid, to put him on the bus? I don't remember. But she says categorically, without qualification, he was with her between 6 a.m. and 7 a.m. If you credit that, that is alibi testimony, because he could not have been the robber, since we know the robbery occurred about 6:45. So that certainly is an important consideration in terms of evaluating whether the trial court somehow committed an abuse of discretion in allowing the tapes. And remember, the counsel today has talked solely in terms of the wife's testimony and her credibility, but that was only part of it. The court, at page 240 of the appendix, in overruling the objection to the tapes, it justifies its ruling saying that it doesn't, quote, it does in fact impeach to a certain extent the witness's previous testimony concerning the, quote, alibi, and second, does show consciousness of guilt. That's an important part, component of its ruling. The defendant, if you listen to the tapes, who's two phone calls.
Consciousness of guilt, you would suggest, is the attempt to encourage wife to fabricate.
Well, to lean on her, to manipulate her, to use body language, however you want to put it. Say, well, you remember, don't you? We had to go to the doctor on December 8th. We had an appointment, remember? Something along those lines. If that had been true, that would have, although you still would have the angle of when was the appointment that day vis-a-vis when the robbery occurred, but clearly he was trying to get her to say, oh, yeah, that's right. I had a medical appointment. I was pregnant, and that's, yeah, it was that morning. And she persisted in saying, no, I don't think that's right. It wasn't that day. I think it was the 11th. But the point is,
the videotape was a successful attempt by the Commonwealth to discredit the theory of the alibi based upon certain information that the fact finder could discern whether or not that alibi was indeed a valid and viable one.
Right, and also a little bit saying the same thing in a slightly different way to impeach his credibility. He got on the stand and gave his account, and the said, I wasn't there, I didn't do it. You could certainly review his repeated attempts in these two conversations, trying to get her to say, oh yeah, I'm the 8th, I had to go to the doctor, as an attempt to bolster an alibi account. But again, it's one, the trier of fact could have concluded it as per this trial court ruling, it reflected consciousness of guilt. And two, it goes to the reasonableness of the trial court's evidentiary ruling. I think manifestly it was reasonable. It was far short of any kind of abuse of discretion, which is something that no reasonable jurist could say that this ruling was reasonable. And I think that just is just plainly an untenable assertion. I would like to briefly address this point about the crudities on the tapes, and there certainly were some. I mean, I almost, in a moment of taking a rare break from my intensive work schedule, I almost felt like just jotting down every obscenity in the record, just to see how many of it hit triple figures. There were a lot. But the point for present purposes is they were all by the wife. The defendant, in comparison, was very, very composed. He did not use any crude language. I don't think he used any profanities as best I could. So when we talk about the party's use of crude, inflammatory language, none of that was on the part of the defendant. I think that needs to be... So when counsel says that there's a concern that these are crude people in lowlifes, well, the defendant certainly didn't exhibit crude language. I think that needs to be kept in mind. Finally, counsel says several points. It was a close case. It wasn't a slam dunk. I submit it was a very strong proof of guilt. I mean, first of all, you have the victim who had no motive to get things wrong, saying quite categorically, this is the robber. She said he was very close to her. She goes home within minutes thereafter, and she's distraught, said she's been robbed. This is very important. 6 days later, the two investigators in the case go to the girlfriend's home, where at that time the defendant still lived with her, and they're investigating unrelated matters, and they come across the victim's cell phone. I think that speaks for itself, because there was no tie between the victim and either... excuse me, the defendant or the girlfriend. The girlfriend certainly said, I don't know the victim. I don't know anything about this phone. I think that is very damning against the defendant. You also have the victim, the same night that the cell phone was found, 6 days after the robbery, quickly and emphatically and unqualifiedly picking out the defendant's picture from a picture array. There's no challenge to whether or not that array was unduly suggestive in terms of the identification. She and the two investigators all said that she quickly said that's the one who did it. She also, a gun was found in a jacket at the girlfriend's home. Girlfriend said, I didn't know anything about that gun. I don't know why I'd be here. And the defendant, excuse me, the victim identified...
Mr. Anderson, would you like some water?
No, I'm just about done.
Okay.
You.
Okay.
The victim said that's the gun and that looks like the jacket. So, and the testimony of the defense was exceedingly weak in comparison. There was a very weak assertion that this defendant, who acknowledged he didn't have a job at the time as a side thing, sold cell phones that somebody else provided him. Well, I think the jury, or I think this was a bench trial. No, it was a jury. the jury in this case could have rejected out of hand the notion that it was just coincidence that the defendant, as part of his side business, just happened to have the victim's cell phone from a robbery done 6 days earlier. So I think the evidence was very strong. In fact, I would submit any claimed error as to the tapes was harmless. It clearly was harmless in the penalty phase because the defendant got the minimum. I think one sentence was mandated and the other he got the minimum. So obviously it's the penalty phase by definition. Any error was harmless. In the guilt phase, I would submit that the strength of the case demonstrates any claimed error was likewise harmless. I don't have anything else really to add beyond what's on brief. I'm glad to answer any questions. Otherwise, I'd ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. Mr. Zaleski?
Yes. The defendant didn't get the minimum. I've talked to him about that. He still wanted me to proceed.
Understood.
By retrial only, and he could get the. Anyway. But.
I'm about to say, be careful what you ask, you just might get it.
I have to leave it to. But as far as the discretion of the court, of the trial court, is concerned, and I said go back and look at the rule, and the rule says this is. Very interesting. It says the probative value of evidence is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. It's unfair prejudice. And that's what the trial, depending on trial judge, to do. Is it unfair to present this tape conversation under these circumstances?
Now, counsel, just to be clear, what are you suggesting the unfair prejudice is?
I mean, I think it's unfair in that it's not giving the defendant the trial he's entitled to, a fair trial, a trial with no preset notions about guilt or innocence. He's presumed to be innocent. He's not presumed to be guilty. That kind of thing. I mean, in the most general sense, unfair. And that's why when I talk about the discretion of the trial judge, this court, knowing that the trial judge said it was fair, obviously, to present that, I think that this court is just in the same position as the trial judge was to make the same call. I don't think that, even though I put it in my brief, I thought it was a discretion issue. It really, if you look at the rule, it's what is unfair, and that can be a call by this court, listening to the disc, reading the transcript, and seeing, is it fair to the defendant to have it submitted under this evidence?
Let me take your point a few steps. I believe that if we had a situation where this tape was played and the defendant had not put on an alibi defense, we would probably have a different set of circumstances. I also believe that if the tape didn't have information supporting the ability of the Commonwealth to discount the alibi defense, in other words, just a tape full of vulgarities, we would probably have another case.
Yeah.
But in this case, the trial court has to weigh what is probative and material, and that is whether or not this alibi defense is viable or not, and weigh it against this other bad stuff, for lack of a better way of putting it, that is encompassed in that alibi discussion. And what I'm going to the Commonwealth say in these situations is, Judge, you can't sanitize the evidence. It is what it is. So how do we overcome that?
Well, I think it's a balancing test. What is the Commonwealth trying to accomplish by putting in the evidence? Is it just merely trying to address the alibi? That's fine. And if the wife testified about the alibi strongly and she needed to be contradicted, then there's more reason to put it in. But if I'm looking at page 2020 of the appendix, and counsel says, is asking her, do you remember where you stayed on the night of the 7th into the 8th? No, I'm not sure. That's probably the night we stayed in the car that night in front. Then a further question, the night of the 7th, you stated it probably was, it could have been, I'm not sure. That's what the Commonwealth was trying to contradict, and there's nothing to contradict. And that really makes it worse, because that makes it more unfair. That's all I have.
Thank you, counsel. We'll come down and greet counsel, and then court will be adjourned.
All rise.